Help Me Somebody from My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. During the break, I successfully located my vinyl copy of this record. I do not have a big vinyl collection, currently do not have a turntable, but I went through a vinyl phase a couple of years back and got a collection really of some of the records that I treasure and value the most, and this is one of them. And what you get with a record is you get nice art and liner notes. And so here's one paragraph from a piece of writing by David Toop. I'm not sure where he writes for, but from January of 05, Amos Tutola's novel, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, was published in London in 1952. We start with the book because the title is central to an appreciation of this record. Some titles are afterthoughts, identification of a product, or they attempt to capture the mood of a collection of songs, but this is a title that stimulates anticipation and controversy even before the music begins. Questions arise quickly enough. Why are these two urbane, successful, and apparently secular white men, Brian Eno and David Byrne, pushing in the bush, haunted by ghosts? And so you get a long discussion of this that takes up one album side of the cover. I miss these beautiful large media. So much more satisfying to handle a record album, and the room for nice photos. It's not the teeny little booklet's not the same. Okay, an excerpt from My Life in the Bush of Ghosts by Amos Tutola. Some of you may recognize this from a satire I did a few years back called Mystery Girl Terrorizes Entire City. That too was a tribute to Amos Tutola, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts. All kinds of snakes. He's describing someone. All kinds of snakes, centipedes, and flies were living on every part of his body. Bees, wasps, and uncontrollable mosquitoes were also flying around him, and it was hard to see him plainly because of these flies and insects. But immediately, this dreadful ghost came inside this house from heaven knows where, and his smell was the smell of his body. His smell was also the smell of his body, and first drove us, it's a little hard to see, it's white on light blue, drove us to a long distance before we came back after a few minutes, but still his smell did not let every one of the settlers stand still. Not at all. He reeks. He's like this kind of living corpse covered with insects. Come back after a few minutes, but still the smell did not leave every part of the settlers stand still, as his body was full of excreta, urine, and also wet with rotten blood and all the animals that he was killing for his food. His mouth, which was always opening, his nose and ears were very hard to look at, as they were very dirty and smelling. His name is Smelling Ghost. But what made me surprised and fear made me surprised and fear most was this Smelling Ghost was many scorpions on his fingers as rings, and all were alive. Many poisonous snakes were also on his neck as beads and belted around belted around his leather trousers with a very big long boa constrictor, which was still alive. That's your paragraph from My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, the book. And so what is this guy? Well, he sounds like the Earth. He's just basically a chunk of the Earth that came to life. He reminds me, though Pan, the Greek god Pan, excuse me a second, the Greek god Pan is tidier and you know, kind of, you might say, cleaner lines and no boa constrictors, rotting blood and flesh and insects and scorpions and snakes as hair pieces and mosquito swarms and clouds of mosquitoes. But he represents the living earth. He represents a life. And that is the smelling ghost. And because he's a ghost, he's walking the line between life and death. He obviously has physical reality. But the word ghost implies haunting. And one of the themes running through my life in the Bush of Ghosts is haunting and exorcism and the haunting of regret. I guess they were listening to a lot of preachers on late night radio and sampling the sermons these preachers were giving. This being in the late 1970s and early 1980s, the album comes out in 81, so it's mostly in the 1970s. And I love listening to late night radio. We're doing my fantasy version of late night radio with this program. That's why I release it on a weekend night. I know that there's like people in Australia for whom it's and New Zealand and stuff for whom it's like they're listening on Saturday afternoon. But maybe day is night, night is day down in Australia, since everything is a little bit backwards. Late night radio is really interesting. And if you're ever driving in your car across the country or countryside late at night, put it on AM radio and scan around the AM dial, because at night, AM radio can carry for thousands of miles by what's called skip signal. It skips across the ionosphere. That's how Grand Ole Opry would broadcast practically to the entire United States from a transmitter just on the other side of the Rio Grande, and the FCC couldn't touch it, and they could pump out a signal at night that would just basically skip and bounce all over the place, and everybody could listen for thousands of miles around. So here we are in our demon-haunted world at this time. These same people who are exorcising Jezebel spirits, there's one, do I have it in this version? I play it in the longer Mike Wallach conversation, the Jezebel spirit. They're exorcising spirits and ghosts, and they're living in a haunted world. And much of what we're seeing, right, we focus on the issues, right, and think, oh, the issues are very important. Okay, what's really going on here? Well, dominionism is what's going on. There's a lot of people living as if we're in the end of the world, as opposed to the beginning of a world, as opposed to a transitional time in the world. When I say the end of the world, I mean the end. The end. Once I had a crush on a Jehovah's Witness girl. This is going back to like the dawn of my astrological age. And I knew this wasn't going anywhere, but I still thought she was just a fascinating young woman. She had this beautiful long blonde hair down to her waist and this very serious, elegant, slightly officious comportment. She reminded me a little bit of Princess Leia. And she had that, just had that regal quality to her. And she kept inviting me to come to church with her. And I wasn't that interested in going to Jehovah's Witness church, but I knew that there was a Jehovah's Witness printing plant a few miles away, one of two in the United States that printed all those booklets, The Watchtower and Awake and all those things. And I said, well, can we go there? And so she, sure enough, arranged a VIP tour of this entire massive campus. I don't know what became of this thing. A Jehovah's Witness campus that was the size of a state university campus. That's what it reminded me of. And they had a call center that, that had every address and phone number in the country. This is back when you thought the internet was AOL chat. And then they took me to the printing area where they had four massive Japanese 10-color printing presses set up. And the tour guide said, see, there's four there, and then there's two open bays where we can put two more, and we're only running two shifts. So we can very quickly almost double our output by going to a third shift and adding two more printing presses. And I'm a man who likes printing presses. And I'm like, this is really exciting. These people have a vision. I mean, it's not my vision, but they have a vision. So we get back to, I forget her name, Carla or something like that. And we get back to her house, and she introduces me to her mom. Now, my girlfriend at the time said, Jennifer, she said, Eric, she likes you. She's inviting you to church. So she introduces me to her mother. I mean, this is me we're talking about, right? An astrologer, like not, I'm not like the, you know, the good Christian boy, but she introduced me to her mom, and her mom said, yes, this is our house, and this is where Carla was born, and she was delivered by her father in her bedroom. They didn't even have a midwife. Dad delivered the baby. And then she said, and this is where we're staying till the end. Now, at this time, Carla's like, she turned her back and stepped away from the conversation. And I said to her mom, the end? She said, yes, the end. What do you mean? The end of the world, when it all ends. I'm like, okay, all right, well, nice place. But lest you think that this is a minority view of some kind, a thing only held by people of some extreme religious persuasion, well, first of all, you're misunderstanding how many of those people there are. And second, the influence this has had from the background on all of politics, on all of social regulation. And the truth is that we do live in a time where it is possible for there to be a very big end known as nuclear war. And we who are alive today have all grown up in the shadow of this thing. The bomb is first used in 1945. Now, there's some people born before 1945, but not that many. They're a small minority of the population. Almost all of us were born after the bomb was first used in Hiroshima. So we have grown up in the shadow of potential Armageddon as a real enough, true enough thing. And we know it. So I think that in the background, that type of thinking and the kind of sect, the large sect of religious philosophy that is associated with end-of-the-worldism, which is loosely, broadly dominionism. Now, people might correct me in my use of that word, and I'm sure there's kind of a term of art, but you probably know what I'm talking about. I would consider it any Christian or Muslim thinking that is centered around Armageddon. And I think this has a profound influence on all of us and all that happens. And it's lurking in the background of everything, like the bomb is. It's the same thing. And yet, you know, you have people who are of the persuasion, well, if the world's going to end, I'm going to make as much money as I can before it ends. Or as Jim Morrison said, I'm going to get my kicks before the whole shit comes crashing down. And so this is a perfect setup for a world where we're not really living genuinely in the moment and planning for the well-being and safety and support of our children and grandchildren and generations beyond that. It's all about using it all up. And the outcome be damned. So, a kind of political atomic bomb went off this week. The issue of woman's right to choose has been muddled and lost by a number of different things. One of them is the emphasis of the so-called women's movement on rape feminism, on a whole cornucopia of feminisms that all surround how terrible men are and what victims women are because rape exists. And this is more powerful than you may imagine. It's kind of an Armageddon thinking of male-female relations, since rape is historically understood to be an act of war and socially understood to be the ultimate violation of trust. And the presupposition, which is repeated over and over again, that men will rape women has done more to destroy the trust and the dialogue between men and women through which they might work out this problem than anything that I know of. And so it percolates down to the social level when feminism can define itself as the Me Too movement, which can be so granular as to think that it is satisfactory to destroy someone's academic career because he makes a joke in an elevator. To wit, the elevator reaches the fourth floor, the bell rings, and the man says, "Fourth floor, ladies' lingerie." That's not really an attack on anyone. That's the oldest teenager, little kid joke that there is. Maybe not the oldest. But the women's movement supported and went after this person. I don't remember this person's name. I learned about it in my study of the Me Too movement, and went after numerous people for nothing. Now you could say, well, but sexual harassment, that's really an issue. Sure, you can say that. Yeah, sure it is. But what's it got to do with rape? Ladies, ding, ding, ladies, lingerie, that's got nothing to do with rape. Then they go after Margaret Atwood, the author of Handmaid's Tale. Now this is really some of the most, let's say, compelling arguments for women's individual freedom and bodily autonomy that have ever been made. The portrayal of this dystopian future where the women are all just basically completely controlled and reproductive pods, and where fetuses are carried through the streets in jars, and people who speak up against church authority in any way are impaled on fences and left to rot where everyone can see them. This is Margaret Atwood, and the Me Too movement went after Atwood as a kind of rape apologist for defending a friend who she knew personally. This is Margaret Atwood, right? This is not some guy on Twitter saying, please, this person's fine. And they went after her. So my point here is that in recent years and decades, really since Andrea Dworkin, who wrote the book Pornography, Men Possessing Women, and feminism redefined itself not as an equality movement, not as a self-actualization movement. In the last segment in Tantra Studio, we're going to hear Betty Dodson writing about feminism as self-actualization, and she was one of the leaders of feminism as self-actualization. No, this is a movement merely attacking not only men but other feminists. Then this whole intersectional feminist thing comes along, where feminists have felt that it is their right, privilege, and prerogative to go after what they consider trans-exclusionary radical feminists. Feminists who think that the trans movement does not belong as part of feminism for whatever reason, and then they, too, are considered the enemy. So it's not just the guy making the ladies' lingerie joke in the elevator. It's not just the man asking to pet a dog on the street who's called a sexual harasser, but the war is then spread against other women, women's activists. And while this is going on, abortion rights are being slowly chopped and chipped away. Day by day, decision by decision, law by law, week by week, month by month, it's all just evaporating. And the reason I think that this particular topic is so important is that the Roe versus Wade decision comes out in 1973. And it establishes a right to privacy between a woman and her doctor, whereby she can choose to terminate a pregnancy in the first 12 weeks of the pregnancy. That's what Roe versus Wade said. And its reasoning is manifold. That they know abortions are going to happen. And what it does is it protects the government's right to regulate a dangerous and controversial, for various reasons, medical procedure. It's not about anyone liking abortion, as anti-choice, anti-abortion activists seem to imply, that it is used as some form of birth control, which it literally is. And there have been some people who have done this. They don't care if they get pregnant. They just go and get an abortion. But it is very few women who do this. Everyone understands how traumatic this is. Losing any pregnancy is traumatic. Women feel it and discuss it and regret it for the rest of their lives that it ever had to happen. And so while the so-called feminist movement is busy going after Margaret Atwood, to whom they owe a profound debt of gratitude, and trans-exclusionary radical feminists, or TERFs, conservatives are working night and day to tear down Roe versus Wade, and they successfully tore down the Equal Rights Amendment. This very simple, like, 10-word amendment, proposed amendment to the United States Constitution. I don't remember the date. I think it is in the early 80s. Well, let's get the 1, 2, 3 of it. And I use Wikipedia for things like this because I know the history and I'm not taking it as authoritative, just as a time reference. Congress had originally set a ratification date of March 22, 1979, for the state legislatures to consider the ERA. Through 1977, the amendment received 35 of the 38 necessary state ratifications. Think about that. 35 of 38 states ratified it, with wide bipartisan support, including both major political parties, both houses of Congress, and Presidents Nixon, Ford, and Carter. The ERA seemed destined for ratification until Phyllis Schlafly mobilized conservative women in opposition. These women argued that the ERA would disadvantage housewives, cause Schlafly never having spent a day as a housewife. She was a lawyer who went to work every day. Mobilized conservative women in opposition. These women argued that the ERA would disadvantage housewives, cause women to be drafted into the military and lose protections such as alimony, and eliminate the tendency for mothers to obtain custody over their children in divorce cases. Many labor feminists also opposed the ERA. I'm not familiar with that term, labor feminist. 1920s movement focused on gaining rights in the workplace unions. That's intuitive. Labor feminists advocated for protectionist legislation, special benefits, and a variant of social feminism. Okay. Also opposed the ERA on the basis it would eliminate protections for women in labor law, though over time, more and more unions and labor feminist leaders turned toward supporting it. Five legislatures voted to revoke the ERA ratifications: Idaho, Kentucky, Nebraska, Tennessee, and South Dakota. The first four rescinded before the original March 79 ratification deadline, while South Dakota legislature did so by voting to sunset its ratification as of the original deadline. However, it remains unresolved legal question as to whether a state can revoke its ratification of a federal constitutional amendment, apparently never been ruled on. In 1978, Congress passed by simple majorities in each house, and President Carter signed it a joint resolution with the intent of extending the ratification deadline to June 30th, 82, because no additional state legislatures ratified the ERA between March of 1979 and June of 82. The validity of that disputed extension was rendered academic. And there you go. No ERA. So in the years following Roe versus Wade, which essentially says that a woman can choose to terminate a pregnancy, therefore to claim back part of her life, to elect to not be a mother, to elect to not give birth, to elect to not have a child with that man, that whoever that might be, remain the closest thing to an equal rights amendment that we have ever had in the United States. And this same conservative movement led by Schlafly, who takes out the ERA, was the same movement that took out Roe versus Wade while feminists and the left was busy attacking Margaret Atwood and other feminists and calling Me Too against everyone and anyone. The conservatives set a goal that seemed impossible, reversing a Supreme Court decision. But guess what? So this thing comes out this week, and it is better to read my article. It is full of all link from the link from the Planetways FM page. It is a tirade, saying things like this decision never should have been decided, and we have to throw it back to the states to make the decision and let the legislatures decide. Well, he knows exactly what many of them are going to do. We know what they're going to do. They're going to ban abortion. Now, this contains special risks in our time. And one of those risks is the possibility of a woman being charged with manslaughter or first-degree murder in the case of a miscarriage. And you can think, well, how can that happen? Well, I can say, how does it happen that no one proves the existence of a virus, but then only 2 months later they order 4.5 billion people under house arrest? You're telling me anyone thinks they know what's possible and what's not possible? I would say all bets are on at this point. And my first thought when the Me Too movement started in 2017 was that this is bad because it is going to undermine trust between men and women on a massive social scale. And then when Roe versus Wade is overturned, because for years it has seemed inevitable, as it just seems that conservatives get lucky. And for example, Trump somehow gets elected and then puts three more people on the court. Trump, appointed a third of the Supreme Court? Are you effing kidding me? And what, I don't even know who there's a couple of Clinton appointees and maybe one Obama or maybe one Clinton appointee left. It's like three, the so-called liberal bloc is three people. The rest have been appointed by the likes of Bush and Trump. I thought this is not good because I have long suspected that when abortion is made illegal, it's not going to be just made illegal as a procedure. It's going to be made illegal in the sense that any miscarriage becomes a crime scene, which must be investigated as a murder scene, yellow tape and all. And what someone calls the police and reports a dead body in the form of my girlfriend had a miscarriage. I think she did it herself. Well, we need a lot of trust between men and women. We are going to need men to protect women from this overreach of authority. Obscene overreach of authority. Legislating right down to the interior of someone's body. Now, I know that fetuses are given this special place, illustrated by Margaret Atwood with these hellacious scenes of these processions through the streets with a priest holding a fetus in a jar as we all look upon how awful this is. And now we may very well be here. So what's the effect of this thing getting out? Well, I don't think very much. First of all, it's a decision on a case, and the court is committed to ruling on that case. It is on the calendar for this term. Now, you heard at the beginning of the program all of these conservative justices facing their confirmation hearings all saying, well, it's a super precedent. I respect Clarence Thomas, former Monsanto attorney at the height of its atrocities, the very height of its atrocities with dioxin and Agent Orange, saying, I respect the right to privacy. Now, whether Anita Hill was a kind of a plant, the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings needed to be about Clarence Thomas's behavior as the chief lawyer for Monsanto, not whether he said something about a pubic hair in a glass of Pepsi. You can think, well, how disgusting that he talked about a pubic hair in a bottle of glass of Pepsi. But wait a second. This is the same Clarence Thomas that ran interference and made sure that not only the height of its atrocities on Agent Orange and dioxin, but also PCBs and many other chemicals, that Monsanto got away with all of it. And here again is another example of the wrong issue being focused on. And people can get all exercised and get their knickers in a twist and hot under the collar about a seemingly credible woman saying this person's is a male chauvinist pig. He made this remark about a pubic hair in the Coke. And then this becomes the focus of days of, I listened to them, of the Clarence Thomas hearings, not his conduct supporting mass murder by Monsanto. Which brings me to the overall politicization of sex. The fetus in this discussion is the figure. I call it the dancing fetus, right? The whole idea of a fetus being removed from a body, and woman's body, and you hear all the horror stories of fetuses being so large, they're alive, and then the doctor kills them, and partial birth abortions where they chop up a living fetus. This is not, as far as I know, what this is about. Partial birth abortions and chopping off babies and infanticide. No, we're talking about a medical procedure much, much, much earlier. Otherwise, we wouldn't be worried about morning after pills. And by the way, the Supreme Court has shown that it's willing to even go after birth control. More politicization of sex. More the government in your bedroom. And this is what we pretty much expect the Supreme Court to do, is to take political stands on things like sex and pornography. Now, they have tended to take a liberal view, truly liberal, like, so you show a picture of sex, obscenity. They create a standard for obscenity that's impossible to meet. I forget which case creates the standard for obscenity. It's so difficult to reach the threshold of obscenity that no jury could ever convict someone on the grounds of that three-prong analysis of what makes something obscene, that it has no redeeming social value whatsoever. Well, Betty Dodson, you're going to hear in the fourth block, Betty Dodson was radicalized, activated. She becomes the Betty Dodson we know and love, the women's pleasure activist, the first sex-positive feminism, the inventor of genderqueer, pretty much the first woman to declare her sexual orientation as masturbation, blah, 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 because Grant Taylor, her then-boyfriend, handed her a box of Hustler magazines and said, no, your pussy's not deformed. Here, look. So right away you lose the no redeeming social value qualification of obscenity. You can prove that even Hustler magazine has redeeming social value because it radicalized one of the very most important feminists of the entire 20th century, perhaps even in all of history. So the Supreme Court is very liberal in what they allow you to say, but not what they allow you to do. To wit, in 1986, there was a decision called Bowers versus Hardwick, which resulted, well, the Supreme Court battle came as the result of a guy being arrested for having sex with his boyfriend in Texas. Okay, in the privacy of their bedroom, not in the park or the shopping mall. There was no lack of consent, blah, blah, blah. No, it was just two guys having fun one night in their bedroom. And they end up in handcuffs in the back of a police car. Certainly at least Hardwick does. And so ensued one of the most atrocious Supreme Court decisions of them all. I'll read a little bit from my article. I recommend this because I'm writing with a lot of context on these issues, because over the years I've taken a special interest in Supreme Court decisions that affect sex. And so some of the most famous ones do. Loving versus Virginia, a black and white person can get married. Griswold versus Connecticut, can a married couple use birth control? Some of these are very important decisions, but the right today we laugh at this. We laugh at the idea that the police could break down someone's door and arrest two women for getting it on because they feel like it, or two guys for getting it on because we think this is. So we need the Supreme Court to intervene, but now this is kind of being turned upon itself. So let me read a little bit of my article. Reading through Alito's decision this morning, I think this was Tuesday morning, I kept flashing back to another ruling, though I could not quite recall what it was. Alito, Samuel Bush appointee, replaced Sandra Day O'Connor, by the way, a genuinely balanced jurist who was she was the swing vote on a 4-5 court. Alito takes many pages of his text reciting all of the places and times that abortion has been shunned and forbidden as a matter of what he thinks is pure morality, which should be upheld by all good and proper people. Then I remembered where the echo was coming from. It was the 1986 Bowers versus Hardwick ruling, considered one of the most absurd decisions in the court's history. What was that about? It allows the state to ban all forms of consensual, quote, sodomy, from anal penetration to oral sex. And I would ask how many of you would be subject to criminal prosecution for what you have done sometime in the last week. In that majority opinion, I didn't have that in the article. That's a little too flip for writing. But not for radio. In that majority opinion, Justice Byron White, you've got to read this to appreciate it, by the way, meaning the Bowers versus Hardwick decision. In that majority opinion, Justice Byron White reasoned that the Constitution did not confer, quote, a fundamental right to engage in homosexual sodomy. And throughout this whole decision, Alito keeps saying, the Constitution does not grant a right to get an abortion. Yeah, well, it's not mentioned. Neither is sodomy. You think Thomas Jefferson is going to put butt-fucking in the Constitution, even though you know they all did it? So, a concurring opinion by Chief Justice Warren Burger. The Chief Justice, I think a Nixon guy, cited the ancient roots of prohibitions against homosexual sex, quoting William Blackstone's description of homosexual sex as a, quote, infamous crime against nature, unquote, worse than rape, and, quote, a crime not fit to be named, close quote. The philosopher Immanuel Kant said approximately the same thing about masturbation at around the same time. Perhaps someday the Supreme Court will weigh in on that matter. Who shall be the opposing parties? Fingers v. Pussy? Schlong v. Fist? Berger's opinion concluded, to hold, quote, to hold, this is a Supreme Court ruling, to hold that the act of homosexual sodomy is somehow a protected fundamental right will be to cast aside millennia of moral teaching. The court overturned it an agonizing 17 years later. This stood for 17 years with a decision in Lawrence v. Texas. Will this decision be stopped by its early release? I'm doubtful. The positions on the court are so entrenched, I don't think the majority wants to give the opinion their rulings are subject to public debate. The court's majority is not, in my view, going to reverse itself because we now know what they're going to do. We may only imagine the consequences, both social and legal, and I need to be on the lookout for need to be on the lookout for many implications that this ruling will have. So the whole point of the Supreme Court as it exists in the United States is so that the judges are insulated from politics so they can actually vote their conscience and not have to be partisan ideologues who are there to take an opinion. And that only that opinion. And in recent history, some of the most liberal, in the true sense, liberal justices were appointed by people like Eisenhower and Nixon, Republicans, conservatives. And that is a testament to the wisdom of lifetime appointments to the court. It means they can't be voted out of office. They cannot easily be removed from office, and therefore they're not subject to the kind of pressure that whomever released this draft, which I humbly propose you should dip into and at least read like five pages of it to get a sense of the tone of it. This completely inappropriate tabloid-like tone, this gloating, like my team finally won the World Series tone of this proposed decision, it will obviously be toned down, but now the draft released is the decision. It's the famous one. No one cares about what's going to be in it. The implications are going to be the same. Now, look, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they're not going to do it this time. But Justice Anthony Kennedy, when he was on the bench, openly invited the states to create laws and to bring lawsuits that would land in the Supreme Court. He was itching, and then he retired, and I think that he was replaced by either Gorsuch or Kavanaugh. So this is very tricky, and it is very difficult, and it's not very happy news, and I'm concerned that people do not understand the implications of this. The the fetus, the dancing fetus, is the figure. It's the thing we're supposed to stare at and be distracted from what really matters. It's really about women. It's about women's right to control what does and does not happen to their bodies. You may not like the choices that some women make, but you know, if they can make a law that affects a woman's uterus, why can't they make a law that affects your spleen and say all people whose last name begins with the letter D have to have their spleens removed on Saturday? It affects all people and their right to bodily autonomy. And we live in a time now where the notion of my body, my choice, the thing that they chant at women's rallies, has been rendered to complete horseshit, because all the my body, my choice people are all the same people who were out there supporting mandatory injections. I mean, and if people use the word rapey sometimes, personally, I can't think of anything more rapey than someone forcibly injecting a metal spear into your body and injecting poison. So on what moral principle, on what principle of law is any person or any woman going to stand to say my body, my choice, when pretty much everyone has given up on the notion of my body, my choice by saying, yes, shove a needle in my arm and shove a needle in his arm too. And that person who doesn't get the needle shoved in their arm, lock him up. Lock them up. A416 it called for locking them up. Now, A416 in New York is no longer a pending law. It's no longer a proposed law. It was withdrawn by its one and only sponsor, who's now a member of the Biden administration. We had that on last week's program in the interview with Bobby Ann Cox. But it's now been made into a state policy. So you can say, oh, my body, my choice, except that person who doesn't have that injection, who hasn't gotten raped by that doctor, can now get thrown in jail for nothing, forever, without a trial, without a hearing, without being taken before a judge. Where is the moral standing to say, my body, my choice? It is an absolutely hollow assertion. You can rationalize it all you want. It's going to be like dancing with two left feet tied together, because the concept of my body, my choice applies through everything, or it does not apply at all. The law must be blind. It is a scale. It is, right, that's the image of Estrella with her blindfold on holding a scale. Justice is blind, meaning that it's only subject to what the what is weighed on the scale. And you can't say, well, we are going to say my body, my choice, except forcing people and children to get injected with a poison. But now we're going to claim my body, my choice in the case of abortion. And oh, by the way, what were we doing the last 5, 10, 20 years? We were banning books at the Canadian border. Thank you, Andrea Dworkin, because they were too explicit. We're making laws about pornography. Okay, maybe you think that's a good idea. Well, then maybe the next we ban pornography, and then someone else is going to ban Andrea Dworkin. So that's why you're. Censorship standard has to go across the board, and you agree that we all get to say what we say or not. And we agree that we have bodily integrity and the right to control what is put inside of our body and what lives in there or not. This is a very serious issue, and I am concerned that there is not the intellectual substance in our culture to be able to think this through. And apparently that has been missing for a long time because we were not thinking it through when it mattered. And now we have to deal with the implications. I am curious to see what happens and what day upon which it is released. It's likely to come out in the June term. In about a month. Usually it's early, early June is when the decisions are released in the June term. I don't know why the New York Times said over the summer. I don't know what their Supreme Court justice has been drinking. A reporter has been drinking. I don't know of any Supreme Court, regular term Supreme Court decisions that have come out during the summer. Maybe I'm wrong. But I know one thing. There's never been a decision released, ever. A draft decision released. There have been vote counts. This is going to go that way. That's going to go that way. Leaked, but not the draft decision. Usually the Supreme Court is a vault. And that, too, is a sign of the times. So don't believe the hype. Question this whole narrative. And the we have a need in understanding this propaganda model to stop looking at the dancing fetus and look at the implications on women, on all people, on sex, on all matters of bodily choice and physical integrity and autonomy. I don't have the energy to do a reading of the chart, and I don't think it's appropriate right now, but I will come back to that. I may do a separate segment or a video about it. There's a lot in there. I have written about it in the article, so click through to that article. The More Things Change, it's called, and it's linked from the article. It's linked from this program, and it's right on the front page of planetwaves.net. Okay, so the rest of the program is recorded from this point on, as was this, but it was recorded earlier in the week or last night. And the music breaks. I guess the next one is Moonlight Glory. Into Mea Culpa, no, as going out of the interview with Mike, and then one of the number eights on this album, a couple of number eights. And what else do I have to say? One or two other things. We had a good month for just donations in April. It rises and falls. These small donations, $5 here, $10 there, very, very important. I still continue to do this program as a volunteer. It takes about 16 hours a week just to do the show, just to pull this all together, get everything arranged, get it right, build the websites, build the letters and all this stuff. Happy doing that. Let's get the basic bills paid. And then please share in my vision and bring some of yours to what it would mean to have some new form of independent media. Now, I know this is largely contingent on the trust that you may have in me as a journalist, as an editor, as a gatekeeper, basically. But I'm doing my best to surround myself with people who are cultivating that same value, and then we get ready to pass this forward at some time in the future. And I promise to build something that will perform its service now and be designed to perform its service in the future. So please give what you can afford. If you can afford a lot and you want to talk to me about merging your vision with mine or to present the funds unconditionally. You just like what we're doing, just like what I'm doing. Give me a ring. 845-481-5616. Now, one note about the Mike Wallace interview. I'm only giving you 55 minutes of it here. It went on for 3 hours and 15 minutes. I can't imagine you want to listen to it, but I do promise you an entertaining and informative experience if you do. So I'm going to present that player right below this one, and then I will place the Betty Dodson presentation on its own right beneath that. All right. Once again, thank you for co-creating this opportunity to have a space where we may have this type of, I'm reluctant to call it a conversation, but there's a lot of conversations on Planet Waves FM. So yes, conversation, and a space where one's mind can be free to explore the nature of reality. And on that note, I leave you in the capable hands of David Byrne and Brian Eno.